KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is KAEB 91.9 on your FM dial. Your one-stop shop in Sandpoint from classic oldies to banging new modern.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, February 17th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebig with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Arrow.
And I want to assure you that, yes, you clicked on the right episode. We are doing armored suckermouth catfishes again, but we are tackling it from a different angle.
And I am really pleased to introduce our guest. It's our first wildlife inspector, Daniel Sahakian, from our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement. So we're going to be doing a little mini-series with Daniel and others where we dig into topics like illegal wildlife trade. Very warm welcome, and thanks for what you do. Okay.
Thank you, guys.
So, Daniel, as a wildlife inspector, how in the heck did plecos come into your work portfolio?
Yeah, so wildlife inspectors, like me, and not just me, about 100 inspectors around the country, what we're doing is we're at the nation's borders, and what we're doing is regulating wildlife trade, and that can come in all forms. So, of course, we're like looking for smuggled ivory, but we're also then looking at, you know, aquarium trade fish shipments that are coming into the country to go to pet stores. And when we look at those shipments, we're looking at species, we're doing species identification, looking for protected species, smuggled species, and just verifying that, you know, what's supposed to be there is in fact there.
Okay. And so last week, Guy and I struggled a bit to bring kind of a focused episode on one genus of the Pterygoplichthys. That's within this really huge family called Loricuridae. So Guy mentioned the armored suckermouth catfishes. I assume there's a lot of species down there in South America that are plecos, in quote. So, I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking? What are some of the major issues that you're seeing with trade with this group of fish in particular?
It was funny to me because we run into a lot of the same problems. Or not problems necessarily, just when people say pleco, that like covers everything basically that has a sucker mouth. You know, if you're talking to someone at the pet store, I want to buy a pleco. Okay, like here's an armored catfish with a sucker mouth. But we use that to our advantage as well when we're working at the ports. When I have a shipment of 15 boxes of fish and I'm going through and opening it, like I kind of organize them. Like, oh, here's a sucker mouth. Here's a pleco, throw it over there. Here's a tetra, throw it over there. Here's a piranha, throw it over there, just so I can kind of orient myself to what I'm looking at. But what we deal with and what I focus on most is really the Hypencestrus, and particularly species coming out of Brazil. And that's because there's one species, the Hypencestrus zebra, which is CITES protected. So this is a fish that's protected on an international basis by the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, a wonderful name abbreviated to CITES. And that CITES listing means it needs special permits for any international movement of the species. And that makes it a priority for us when we're working at the ports, looking for these CITES permits and looking for these protected species permits. The fish is endemic to Brazil. So obviously you would think, you know, shipments from Brazil would be a high priority for us to look at for that species. But it's actually kind of interesting. What we find is we see it coming from a lot of other countries, a lot of neighboring countries or a lot of Asian countries.
So I'm a little curious. Are there tons of these shipments coming in every day that you just need to be there all the time? Or are you called in on special occasions? How do you know which boxes have the fish in it? How does that all work?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of everything. We're there looking for illegal trade, but we're also there kind of regulating the legal trade. So we have fish importers, a lot of pet stores, fish brokers that just deal with fish, and they're doing things legally. You know, they have a shipment coming in, they declare it to us. There's a whole system of declarations for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They say, hey, on this date, I'm going to have 10 boxes of fish. They give us a list of what fish they have on their invoice. Yeah. And then we can decide, you know, maybe we want to look at this one, maybe it's high priority, maybe it's not, just depending on what they have and the workload of the inspectors as well. You know, there aren't that many of us. So again, prioritizing live things, protected things, that's usually where our focus is going to go. But then we're also sometimes finding shipments. I went and looked up an old case. You know, we were walking around a warehouse once and we found a shipment moving from Colombia, actually, to Hong Kong, and it was just offloaded in Newark, New Jersey, just because it was changing planes. We happened to see it and walk by it. We took a look at it. And when we looked at it, we found that they actually had this protected species, Hypencestra zebra, which is again native to Brazil, coming from Colombia. And it was declared as a different Hypencestra species, Hypencestra furnaculus, I believe, which is a Venezuelan species. So it was moving internationally without permits, and we were able to take action. And we kind of honestly just stumbled into that one. That's again, working with the declared shipments, as well as targeting and looking for those undeclared shipments.
Last week, we talked a lot about how species down in South America are like constantly being discovered. Things are maybe named different things. We talked briefly about the L naming system. Do you see issues with how things are labeled, or are people misidentifying fish at all?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it was the L numbers are an interesting point for us as well. This L number classification, it's not quite scientific, even though I would say they did a great job of kind of classifying and organizing to the best of their ability all these different kinds of fish. But a lot of times it's kind of based on like color pattern, harvest location, even though a lot of times they were lying about harvest location because they didn't want someone to go take their fish that they were harvesting to sell them. So it's not a super good way to identify them. And you also see a lot of like funny stuff when you go on the forums. It's like, oh, well, I'm just making up an L number here. Like, well, I've only seen juveniles of L98. And it's like, oh, maybe because when they get older, it's actually the colors change. Maybe it's a different one. There's a lot of problems with the L number classifications. As you said, a lot of these fish are not scientifically identified, but it is always changing. I thought it was funny because I was like going through some of my notes in the past where I've had cases on things being misdeclared. And I've saw a couple new Hypencestra species were classified in 2023 that I wasn't aware of. So it's always evolving in that sense. We could talk about L numbers all day. But, you know, we don't accept them in the U.S. Like on those invoices of fish, when we get a list of fish from Brazil, I can review it. And our regulations say they need to have a genus and species listed for every fish. If you have an undescribed fish, you're not going to have
a genus and species.
You're not going to have it. But you will have the L number there because the trade uses L numbers. And Brazil does accept L numbers. So on their Brazilian export permits, on the Brazilian invoices, they use L numbers, and that's acceptable. It's just not acceptable for the U.S. I keep going back to Hypencestra. Hypencestra zebra, L46, is a protected species. You need special permits for it to be in trade. Brazil doesn't actually allow any exports of this fish anyways, so they shouldn't be coming out of Brazil, which is, again, why we see them coming out of other countries. But then if you have a shipment and your paperwork just says Hypencestra species, like, how are we supposed to know it's not the protected one? You're not lying, necessarily. You're just not giving us the species name. And then we have to go look at the shipment, and then we have to ID what fish we actually have, which can be a whole other challenge in itself.
So this Hypencestra zebra, are people breeding these in captivity so it could be legally shipped between countries? So it's not just wild caught exports?
Yeah. So there's a lot of breeding. That's, again, one of the reasons we see it coming from foreign countries. We know there's a lot of breeding happening in Southeast Asia. There's a lot of breeding happening in the U.S. as well. So yeah, you can definitely see that. And they're expensive fish. They go for about $300 a fish, which we're talking about just like normal freshwater aquarium fish. That's pretty expensive. We're going to ignore koi, where they go for like hundreds of thousands of dollars for some reason. That might be its own episode. But
yeah. I like to keep mine to under $5 when I buy a fish. Yeah.
Just that's normal, I would say.
Can you describe what Hypencestra zebra looks like? I'm assuming it's black and white. It looks like a pleco, but anything else?
Classic sucker mouth catfish. So, you know, your kind of upright armored body with its fins kind of splayed out with a not super high dorsal fin, but fairly high. It is black and white striped. They're kind of straight lines. That's usually what you're looking for. Really stark black and white with straight lines is what you see with the Hypencestra zebra. And for those listening, you know, go online and just start searching these Hypencestra, and you can see the zebra is pretty unique in that the lines are pretty straight. Once you start getting into some of the other ones where they have little squiggly lines, then it's like they all look the same to me, really. Especially when, you know, you have a bunch of fish in a bag of cloudy water that don't look happy and aren't happy to see me. So
it sounds like this one, it stands out. It's pretty easy to identify, and it's an endangered. If you have a species, one that's maybe endangered or that trade is highly regulated, and one that's very common, but they are very hard to distinguish, how do you go about, when you have a shipment of those, determining what you have?
Yeah, it can be super difficult. And a lot of what we do too is, you know, we try to work with our international partners. So I have a great contact in Brazil that I've worked with on many cases. He sees these fish a lot more than I have. And actually for this, I reached out to him and just said, hey, can you like send me some of the problem fish that you're seeing? And so he sent me a list of some of the common traffic species and what they're misdeclared as. Again, I can just yell out L numbers that people can look up. But like, for example, L82, which is not allowed fish, is commonly trafficked as L253. And these are both black plecos with gold spots. So it's like, they look very similar. Sometimes I'm honestly taking pictures of these fish and sending them to this guy in Brazil and be like, hey, what is this fish? And he'll like tell me like, oh, that's this one, we're good, that's this one. Or he'll say like, hey, can you like open the fin a little bit, take it out. So that's really one of the most helpful things that I've found. Again, it's when we're doing these inspections, we're usually not in a lab. We're at the airport in a cargo facility about to get run over by like a forklift, and there's like poor lighting. It's usually really cold or really hot. It's like never comfortable. Yeah. So anytime we cannot take the fish out of the bags is super ideal. But if we really have to, we will like take the fish out. We'll stand there. We'll get little scopes and we'll start looking. And if we have to count rays, we'll count rays.
Yeah. It seems like you don't have the luxury of like, okay, if you're dealing with, you know, an item like you said, ivory. Now, granted, yes, you don't need to genetically ID ivory, but something where it's dead and it's not going anywhere, you can do genetic testing and stuff. With these live fish, I imagine people want them being shipped as quickly as possible just for the health of the fish. And so you don't have that luxury of time either.
Yeah, for sure. Technically, I could hold the shipment. I could move the whole thing to a nice air-conditioned lab with scopes and everything fancy that we need to ID, but no one's happy when that happens. The fish aren't happy because they're stuck in these little bags. Stressed. The importers aren't happy because they want their fish to sell. And again, back to these L numbers, like a lot of them that are undescribed, they don't actually have good ID characteristics that at least I can find anywhere. It's again, just like, oh, well, we caught it in this river. It's black and white and it's a fish. So like, maybe it's this one, maybe it's that one.
From a conservation standpoint, why is it important to have a handle on those undescribed species?
Without the range data and population data, like how can anybody know how they're doing? That's a problem. Hypansister zebra is a good example of this in that like when it was first discovered, it was overfished super heavily. And that's why the population's struggling now. And that was before it was officially classified. And so we're not sure if any of these others that are not officially classified, what their populations are, what their status should actually be.
I'm curious, you say you're in New Jersey, is that correct, Newark?
Now I'm in DC. I sit at a desk in headquarters doing a lot more international cooperation. But yeah, I was in Newark before.
Okay. Well, I have more questions about your current thing in DC too. So a typical day in Newark, what percent of declared fish shipments do you actually have the capacity to inspect?
Yeah, it really just depends like what's going on that day, to be quite honest. I like fish, so I would always prioritize my live fish shipments, but that's just not always the case. I think that we have 5 inspectors in Newark right now. Someone always has to be in the office answering phones. We have someone always processing declarations. So that leaves about 3 inspectors to go out and do these kinds of inspections. I'm getting to your answer in a long way, but of course we're supposed to be at the airport, which is where we're seeing fish shipments, obviously. We have to be at the ocean port, which there's like 6 warehouses that cover the ocean port. There's also a FedEx facility, a UPS facility, and a mail facility. So between the 3 people, they need to be at all those locations at the same time. So some days we hit all the fish shipments and other days we hit none. On average, I think maybe we're covering like 25% of live fish shipments coming into Newark.
How often do you find violations?
Well, it depends what you want to really count as a violation. Because if we're going by what the regs say and you need to supply a genus and species, every shipment is a violation because they don't have them. If you want to talk about more like kind of criminal violations or maybe not quite criminal, but, you know, questionable violations, they're still probably in about 40 to 50% of the shipments. And it's just that we don't have the bandwidth, the background information, or, you know, other capabilities to kind of deal with them appropriately.
Seems like intent would be part of it. Like, if people just don't know and they're not trying to, you know, maliciously ship improper fish versus people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, for sure.
Can you talk a little bit about CITES and just why is the United States involved with this international issue? Why are we dealing with places like Brazil and just kind of why was CITES set up? Why is it important?
Pretty much every country is a member of CITES. 185 countries now are part of this international agreement. And really the international agreement was made to protect species specifically that could be driven to extinction by trade. So this is not looking at climate change. This is not looking at any other issues that could be affecting the species. It's really focused on species affected by trade, which again, Hip and Sister Zebra, as we said, affected by trade, over collected for fish trade, traded, and that's what is leading to its decline. So the whole CITES system works on permitting. Say you're in Indonesia and you're captive breeding these Hip and Sister Zebra and you want to ship them to the U.S., you need to get a permit from the government that says, yep, you captive bred these fish here in Indonesia. How many fish do you have? Maybe you have 100. You apply for a permit with all that background information. So you can maybe send a picture of your breeding facility, how many fish you bred last year, all that kind of background info. The government would then either say, yeah, you have provided enough information. No, you haven't. Issue that permit. And then when you're taking that shipment out of the country, an officer in Indonesia, I'm not sure what their titles are in Indonesia, has to then verify that permit. So maybe the permit was issued for 100 fish, but you only bred 90 that week. You only have 90 fish to send. They need to verify and write in on the permit that there are 90 live Hip and Sister fish in this permit, and that shipment comes to the U.S. When our wildlife inspectors, or me, when I was in Newark, we would then accept that permit. We would go out and look at the shipment, count the fish, and then we take that permit and collect it. And then at the end of each year, per CITES, all countries then need to report back on like what international trade occurred. So we have to go back and say, like, we had 2,000 Hip and Sister Zebra come from Indonesia, we had 1,000 come from here, 1,000 come from there. And that's for every species protected by CITES, not just the fish. This international cooperation and collaboration is super important. Wildlife trade, especially the illegal wildlife trade, all hinges on this international nexus. It's moving things from one place to another. Yeah. And it's these large criminal organizations often that are also, again, moving things across boundaries and working together across boundaries. So we really need, as a conservation community, to be working together across these international lines to save these species that we care about.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's a good point. So obviously, this is dealing, the I in CITES is international, but you can have domestic wildlife crimes too. And the U.S. is a really big country. So, you could imagine things being shipped from one part of the country to another. And it wouldn't fall under CITES jurisdiction because it's not international. So what kind of domestic laws do we have that affect the wildlife trade?
All of our inspection authority comes through the Endangered Species Act, which I think everyone knows the Endangered Species Act, you know, listing species as endangered or threatened. Of course, those apply domestically as well. That wouldn't be our wildlife inspectors applying Endangered Species Act laws domestically. That would be our special agents, and hopefully you'll have them on soon to talk, and they can really expand more on that kind of domestic side. Downstream from Lacey Act, which is a really cool and I would say innovative law that was passed back in 1900. So it's really one of the oldest wildlife laws. It was created to prevent, you know, hunting violations between states, where someone might go to, I don't know, Colorado, shoot a deer illegally, and then like drive to Utah. And then, well, the Utah police have no kind of jurisdiction because you didn't violate any laws in Utah, and the Colorado police don't have any jurisdiction because you're not in Colorado.
Oh, God.
So they created this Lacey Act to say that, like, if you go in to a place and commit a wildlife violation and then take that and move that item to another state, it's in violation of the Lacey Act. And that's really where that domestic regulation goes with Lacey. But what's super interesting with Lacey Act is we also use this on the international stage as well. So if you have a fish that was collected in Brazil illegally, say L236, just to throw out, which is another Hip and Sister that our good friend in Brazil notified me is a species they can't have in Brazil. So if we see that fish coming out of Colombia, for example, when it doesn't occur in Colombia, it must have come out of Brazil. And if we can work with the Brazilians, we can get a Lacey violation on, you know, that illegal possession of L236. It was taken out of Brazil illegally, it was imported into the US, and we can have a Lacey violation in that way as well.
CITES, Lacey Act, what kind of teeth do these actually have? I guess CITES in particular, you mentioned the Lacey Act, but it sounds like you actually can be prosecuted under that. Under CITES, is it individuals? Is it get applied to the countries that are party to this convention? If you find a violation, what actually happens or can
happen? Yeah, it kind of depends. It's all of the above. At the broadest level, because this is international cooperation between countries, like if there's a country that is a problem country, maybe they're not doing adequate, what we call like a non-detriment finding to show that trade in a species that they have is not detrimental to that survival of that species. So for example, in the US, of course, we have a lot of American alligators. We export those alligators. And there's been robust scientific research to show, like, we can take this many alligators out of the wild every year and allow them into trade. If a country's not doing that, trade could be banned from that country. Ladies, as the body, could say, like, we're not allowing any wildlife trade from this country until they're able to do better scientific research on particular species. So, like, in one sense, that's the broadest scale impact or teeth that CITES could have, would be like a trade ban or a trade suspension on a country level. Going back and pulling this back to like the personal level. So if you have a shipment of fish that you're not supposed to have or you smuggled, again, a lot of this then goes back to intent. You know, were you just buying a fish and you didn't know what you had, which we've seen plenty of times. And this goes up to the inspector's fact gathering, because again, a lot of these fish look very similar. And even I'll still go on the forum sometimes just to see what fish people are talking about. They'll be arguing on the forums like, oh, well, this is L401. And then L401 is not allowed to be shipped out of Brazil. And then 10 other people like, no, that's L333, which is allowed out of Brazil. So, you know, if it's that person that just doesn't quite know what they have, we're probably not going to throw the book at them, for lack of a better term. We really want to get people into compliance and teach people about what's going on. So maybe in that instance, if it's a first violation, we maybe would just like refuse the shipment. Either we'd re-export it back to the country of origin, say like, hey, like, it's going to go back, just fix your paperwork, get the proper permits, something like that. And then we'll let you bring those fish back in. If it's somebody that's actively smuggling these fish, we have documentation, which is always funny too. Like, sometimes we'll see, they'll be calling our inspectors stupid, like, we don't know anything and we're going to get everything by them. You know, then there's a little more there. The easiest thing is we can always write tickets. We make seizures of these fish. And if there's really like a criminal pattern, we're working with our agents who are doing those larger scale criminal investigations, and you could get jail time.
One quick point of clarification with CITES in particular, but also these other applicable laws. On this show, we tend to focus more on freshwater fish because we're U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and that's within our domain. Marine fishes and the ESA and stuff, I know for marine fishes with the National Marine Fisheries Service. So is that the same thing with CITES, where they're dealing with marine and you guys are freshwater? Or how's that divvied up?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, so Fish and Wildlife Service, from a CITES enforcement perspective, we do all of the wildlife, all the CITES species wildlife we regulate. Talking fish, like sharks, a lot of sharks are CITES protected now. The Fish and Wildlife is the CITES enforcement authority for sharks. But of course, we work with our NOAA enforcement officer partners on those kinds of cases as well, because they have their own laws that they're applying and their own, like the SIMP program, for example, which is a seafood import monitoring program that they're working on for not just sharks, a bunch of other fish species as well in the marine environment. And actually not even fish, they cover sea cucumbers as well. So can't forget about our good sea cucumber friends.
Yeah.
There is that kind of interagency collaboration again. And when we're talking about the CITES side and the kind of that background stuff, you know, NOAA, National Marine Fisheries, is doing a lot of that background research on population studies and then working with our fish and wildlife biologists to form those management plans for any CITES species. Really, though, CITES fish aren't super abundant in CITES listings, which I think is unfortunate. I think there are a lot more fish that should be CITES listed. They meet the requirements. Maybe this is a hot take, I don't know. But when people say, what's the most trafficked animal? If you ask that to a school group or something, everyone's going to say elephants, which is kind of like, that's because everyone's conditioned and we all hear about elephant trade. The answer that you'll hear a lot in times from NGOs and even the Fish and Wildlife Service sometimes is pangolin is the most trafficked animal. And I would say pangolin is probably the most trafficked land vertebrate, but I would say fish are by far the most trafficked animals globally.
I don't think
it's close.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. I have two questions that are related, but the first one is, a lot of the shipments you see coming in, are they going direct to like a pet store, or are they going directly to, say, a hobbyist at home now with how easy it is to just get things in the mail? So that's part one, I guess.
Yeah, I think by volume, they probably go to like these larger fish brokers. So not even necessarily a place that has like a brick and mortar store, kind of like your big online sales, or yeah, like a warehouse of just like that then sells to fish stores. But also a good amount of importers do have their own stores as well. You know, we are seeing an increase in hobbyists ordering fish by themselves. A lot of those don't come air cargo. You know, when we have 20 boxes of fish from a foreign country, they're coming on a plane via air cargo. Some of those smaller shipments are coming, you know, in parcels, like so FedEx, UPS, DHL, because it's not going to be 10,000 fish. It's going to be like 10 fish.
Yeah. And then from the consumer side of things, is there anything that folks can do to maybe become better educated, or any calls to action to folks ordering these fish from other places?
Yeah, I think the broken record thing we always say is like, it's good to be an informed buyer of wildlife stuff. So always be asking questions like, where did it come from? Where does it come from to begin with? You know, not where did you buy it from? Like, where, yeah. What country does it come from? Is it a protected species? What's the population in the wild like? Obviously, we can say buying things that are not wild caught is usually ideal. If it's not caught in the wild, if it's being bred in captivity, it's having less impact on wild populations, which I think is always preferable. The kind of catch-22 that you get with that a lot of the time is, especially for these rare fish, is like, well, where'd those founder stock for those captive bred fish come from? Often they're poached from the wild populations illegally. So really just being informed and asking questions.
Okay. Do you ever find shipments going out of the U.S., say, with maybe some of our really cool native and potentially imperiled species?
Yeah, we do. Alligator gar are pretty popular on the international stage. They are super cool and super unique fish. And there's a lot of people that just like big fish, which I don't know how these people have enough money to keep these large fish. And some of the, like, the pupfish and stuff, some of
like, the super endemic,
not allowed to be in trade, but are definitely in trade. You'd be surprised. And I've seen devil's hole pupfish in trade. We've seen them for sale. We've them invoiced. I've seen tanks with labels of having them in them, but the fish aren't in there. Just whether they took them out before we got there, I can't say.
But seems dumb to put devil's hole pupfish on the invoice. You'd think that you'd know.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always two invoices. Not always, but you know, there's an invoice they give us and there's an invoice they give the person buying the fish.
Still, that seems like a pretty...
We're getting slightly off topic with the killies and the pupfish, but you know, that's a whole nother trade. And there's fish people, and then there's like fish people. The killie people fall into the fish people, and honestly a lot of these pleco people fall into like that extra fish people.
Okay, level. We're gonna have to cover the killie fishes with you here at some point in the future.
Bringing this back to the plecos, I don't know what you're allowed to say and what you might not be allowed to say, but just in any particular cases related to these fish.
Some of the things we see, and like I touched on earlier, that case where we had fish, you know, moving from Colombia internationally to Hong Kong. We see a lot of these fish moving to countries that border Brazil, either by land border, like through the rainforest, or along the river. So like going to Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, and then these fish getting kind of commingled in. So now you're taking Brazilian endemics, maybe a black and white swirly striped fish, and you're taking that and mixing it with all the black and white swirly striped fish that are endemic to Colombia, and then you're shipping those out. And so we've seen that where you're taking these Brazilian endemics that are not allowed in trade, being moved to Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, and then being shipped internationally through the U.S. And that's just really because how the U.S. is positioned as such a large global trade hub, just in terms of the number of flights we have. A lot of stuff that's moving from South Central America to Asia is passing through the U.S. just because we have a lot of plane traffic. So we see a lot of those cases where those fish are going from Brazil, smuggled into Colombia, then smuggling through the U.S., misdeclared as a third or fourth species, and then going on to Hong Kong. And again, whether it's without CITES permits, it's a Lacey Act violation, there's a whole bunch of things that we could be hitting on there. So those cases are pretty common, I would say, but not the easiest to catch. And that's just because, you know, we're set up to look at U.S. imports and exports, not as much in transits, but we still do the work.
Okay.
Now that you're in DC, how do we make this better? How do we improve our efficiency at detecting violations? How do we, I don't know, is there any way to increase capacity using, you hear about the blockchain and AI and stuff, which I don't know how useful that might be, but you know, you're talking about having this chain of custody. So it seems like that's relevant to trade and stuff like that. So how do we fix any issues that we have?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny that you hit on the blockchain one. And again, just branching off and setting up for next episodes, possibly the CITES standing committee meetings actually happening this week. So this morning I was listening into those meetings as I was looking at back at old fish cases. And one of the things that they're talking about there is how you can use blockchain and QR codes to kind of track caviar from origin throughout the trade process. So that's obviously an option. And this traceability is a really big thing. Again, showing where something came from and following it through to the end user via blockchain is a large topic of discussion. not a tech wizard by any means to really know how feasible it is or how expensive it would be, but those kind of discussions are there. I think even at the more basic level, a lot of it just is education and outreach to the public. A lot of people just don't even know we exist as a wildlife inspection program, much less the Fish and Wildlife Service, which I still know people don't know about.
Yeah.
So really just that kind of outreach and basic level of knowledge, like this is what we do. These are some of the problems. This is CITES, an international agreement that we are part of, that we work with to protect species. Really, ideally, we would have more staff. But again, working with our partner agencies is really important. Of course, like Customs and Border Protection, they're the big players on the border. If you've ever flown internationally and someone's taken your apple away that you got on the plane, those would be like agriculture inspectors, yeah. For example. We work with them all the time. They're looking for pests that could harm agriculture. We're looking for wildlife for conservation purposes, but there's often a lot of overlap there. And they have employees by the thousands where we're, again, in the hundreds. So
yeah. We
work with them all the time to say, like, hey, if you see this, call us, let us know, and we'll come out and take a look at it. That kind of interagency cooperation is super important. And again, that international cooperation is super important. One of the things I'm doing at headquarters is we're receiving info from foreign countries, and we'll have foreign countries notify us like, hey, we have a shipment coming from the U.S., they provided this permit. It looks a little suspicious. Could you verify that this is real? And so we can go back and look and say, yep, that's a real permit. Or, yeah, no, this is fake. I don't know where they got this. That's probably a legal shipment. You should probably seize it. The cooperation and collaboration and the education, those are kind of the big points that I would say.
That's great. I'm curious how you got to where you are. How do you become a wildlife inspector? Yeah. What kind of education, what kind of training do you have to do just for folks who might be interested in this kind of career path?
I can't give you like a super straightforward answer on like what's required, which I guess is nice. There isn't one type of education or background that really makes a good wildlife inspector, which is, I think, kind of cool. For me personally, like I was an environmental science major. I worked in wildlife refuges for 4 years before coming to Office of Law Enforcement. I was term doing education and outreach at both as at Patuxent and at Chincoteague. Mm-hmm. And I was term, which is always unnerving because it's like, well, I have a job. Who knows? I was also a pathway student, which is also super helpful because they were always looking out to see like what positions were opening up. And Newark was looking for wildlife inspectors. We have a lot of inspectors that don't necessarily have that wildlife background that are great inspectors. And, you know, often what makes a good inspection team is people that have all these different kind of facets of information, whether that's like targeting via computers or whether that's being super observant on what stamps look suspicious or what handwriting doesn't match other handwriting. Like all these really cool, unique skills can make an inspector. And it's really like when inspectors are working together that I feel like we have like the best impact.
Yeah.
Nice.
A diverse team. So you guys aren't like cops. You're not arresting.
You guys get badges and guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have badges, but we don't have guns. So our inspectors do not carry. Our special agents do carry weapons, but we do have badges. So you'll see our wildlife inspector uniform. We do wear a badge.
Yeah,
you probably at least get like a box cutter to open up the shipments.
We do have box cutters.
Yes. Good.
Many knives and box cutters open all the boxes.
Do you have dogs working with you? We had a dog up here, Doc, that worked with our wildlife inspectors. How many dogs and what's kind of that about?
We don't have too many right now. We're trying to work on revamping our canine program. I think we might only have 4 canines working right now. We're looking to expand that program. And yeah, they're trained just like drug dogs or money dogs to smell out wildlife stuff. So I don't know if any are trained to smell live fish at the moment. But
I was going
to
ask about that because Doc, I think, was trained for like turtle shells and different.
Like reptile skins, tortoise stuff, seahorses. I think there's like 18 basic scents they're trained on. And then their handlers can like work on expanding out from there.
You pluck a species dog. Water.
Is that so smell? It's like you have like these actual pieces of whatever, the fish, the ivory, that are coming off and then need to be landing on the olfactory receptors in the dog's nose. If the fish is in the water, I mean, I guess you could get the fish out and give it to the dog and hopefully it doesn't like think it's a chew toy and have it sniff it. But otherwise, it seems like it might be tough to smell things that are in water.
Yeah, I'm not a dog. I do not know dogs. Abilities to smell through water. I would assume, though, that's why I think everything that I can think of that they're trained on is not transported in water. But maybe you've unlocked a new smuggling method.
Are they shipping them in bags? How are these fish being shipped?
Yeah, they're usually shipped in a bag. So there'll usually be multiple bags in a box For some of the larger fish, you will have a single fish in a box. So like for black piranhas, those are usually shipped in their own plastic box. So they don't bite through a plastic bag.
Oh, man. That'd be bad. Yeah. Okay. I guess I'd be curious, why Brazil? Is that a place you're going to continue to focus on? Or what are some other areas that you might be looking at?
The real reason we work with Brazil so much is just like we have good relationships with them on the international level. Again, I have contacts that I've met there. I've been down there. I've met people at CITES conferences, and they're really willing to work with us, and we're super excited to work with them. So that's one reason we're focused on Brazil. But also, again, just going back to CITES, and like this Hypencestris is a Brazilian endemic. So when we're looking for CITES species, if it's from Brazil, that's part of the reason why that kind of relationship and that focus is there. And of course, again, Brazil is the biggest country in South America. The Amazon River is mainly in Brazil, and you have so much diversity of fish down there. So that's one of the reasons.
Have you seen the actual habitat where Hypencestris zebra is from?
I have not. I only got into the cities in Brazil. I didn't get out into the rainforest. That's next trip, I'm told. You know.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
No, no one told me that. I wish, though.
And I guess why should people care about what's happening to fish in other countries like Brazil? Why should we care if their endemics are doing well or not?
There's like a lot of, I would say, controversy around kind of this topic and with trade specifically. And a lot of people think that the only way these fish will survive is if we take them out of the wild and have them in a fish tank, like that's how we're going to save the species. And maybe that's true, but like also what's the goal if like the only fish we have are in glass tanks in your house and not in the river where they belong? So I think it's just important to make sure that we're doing what we can, again, as consumers, as a global population, to protect all species globally. I would love to go down to Brazil and see these fish in their native habitat. I mean, they're cool to see in fish tanks, but I would love to go down there and see them. Then going into the socioeconomic side of things as well, these fish are what a lot of the people down in the Amazon, this is how they make their money, is harvesting not just Hypencestris, but other fish species as well. If they're gone, there's no way for those people to make money anymore. So then even just going back to that side, like we need to respect those native populations as well that are working to harvest fish and have a manageable population of fish for years to come.
We hear a lot these days about, you know, gold mining in the Amazon. And if you're not allowed to catch these fish and sell them, maybe there's not as much of an incentive for local populations to maybe oppose things like that. So the idea of artificial propagation or in-tank propagation versus wild capture, is it a case-by-case basis on which is more sustainable?
Yeah, I think there isn't really a good answer. There's like kind of benefits to each. Like the benefit of captive breeding would be like you're generally going to have healthier fish, for example, because they don't have parasites that, you know, we find are rampant wild populations. You're also, again, not degrading wild populations, or to a much less extent degrading wild populations by buying these captive bred fish. But again, then on the flip side, buying those wild fish, you are in a way supporting native communities or local communities. Something that we see with that too, though, is often, especially when you're getting into like the criminal networking realm of side, like a lot of times those local communities are getting like a very minuscule portion of the profits of this kind of trade, and a lot of that is by being reaped by the middleman or the end seller. It is kind of case by case. There isn't a good clear answer of what's better. If people are doing the wild harvest sustainably, like I think that's awesome, but then you have to also err on the side of caution. Like, is it sustainable when we've just gone over that? Like, we don't even know how many of any of these fish there are, what their ranges are, what their populations are. There isn't an easy answer, I would say, unfortunately.
I liked your point earlier, though, about being an informed consumer and outreach. I mean, you're not really sure what impact you're having on the back end when you buy that fish. Like, how's it affecting the people in the origin country? How's it affecting the ecology there? So just really being intentional with purchases and thoughtful with where you're buying from and knowing what's happening there. Is there mining there? Deforestation? How are things being impacted? So I think being a little bit more informed at the global level is probably really good.
Not to be extra, extra grim, but like the unfortunate thing too is like when you have these fish moving internationally, they are super stressed and often there's a lot of loss. Like a lot don't make the trip, and that like price is kind of built into your purchase price when you're at the pet store. So that fish store can make a profit noting how many fish they lost when they tried to bring those fish in. And that's not just them. It's the fish that are lost in original transit that were captured. Maybe they got stuck in the net weird. Loss is a part of it as well. Our inspectors are working to make sure that fish are being moved humanely. I noted earlier, a lot of times we're working in really cold areas or really hot areas, and fish don't do well in very cold areas generally or very hot areas. It's working with the airlines as well to say like, hey, I see those fish under the sun over there. Like, let's bring them inside where it's not 100 degrees. Just that humane transport is a super actually important point as well.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Thanks, Daniel. This was super interesting. Sounds like we got some potential future topics to revisit with you and others. So we're looking forward to that.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about fish and the wildlife inspection program and law enforcement and what we do. One of our big goals is to be better at getting out and talk about the problems and what we do. So again, appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, great job. Get out there and live with, live from, discover and enjoy all the fish, especially those international fishes like Hypencestrus zebra. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Public sector workers and lawmakers rallied in front of the Alaska State Capitol in Juneau on Valentine's Day, too, according to organizers.
Fair wages! Respect! Retirement security! Fair wages! Respect! Retirement security!
Some of the roughly 70 demonstrators at the Alaska State Employees Association rally carried signs calling on the governor to release a delayed statewide salary study. Union leaders filed a lawsuit Tuesday accusing Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration of illegally withholding the report funded by lawmakers in 2023. The governor's office says it hasn't received a final report, and they say drafts and revisions they've asked for from the HR consultants conducting the study are legally protected from disclosure. Union leaders were joined by a bipartisan group of majority caucus lawmakers who made addressing the state's worker shortage a key campaign priority. The largely Democratic bipartisan coalitions controlling the House and Senate are pushing to pass a bill that would create a new defined benefit system to replace the state's existing 401k-style defined contribution plan. Advocates say it's one reason the state is struggling with vacancies and turnover. Leaders are optimistic they'll come up with a pension bill that can pass both chambers, but the bill's fate at the governor's desk is uncertain. Adverse economic conditions are muddying the future of a plan to put Alaska's largest solar farm in Nikiski. The company developing the project withdrew its contract from state regulators last week, saying the project investor deemed the project would no longer be economic in its current form. Jen Miller is the CEO of Renewable IPP, the company that brought the proposal to HEA. She says several economic factors since the start of the year compounded to prompt the withdrawal.
One of those is just uncertainty around the solar investment tax credits. And not that those have changed yet, but there's uncertainty in the market on what the percentages will be in the timeline, like eligibility timeline. So we received some construction bids that were, you know, kind of higher than industry benchmark.
Miller says she can't give details about how much costs surge, but that the current economics mean the project needs to be, quote, reimagined and worked through. HEA spokesperson Kieran Baker said Friday that Miller briefed HEA's board of directors on the setback earlier this month and that the contract withdrawal, quote, isn't at all uncommon. She says the project still aligns with HEA's goals of diversifying their energy sources to be less dependent on natural gas. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
Matson. Delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at matson.com/Alaska.
Support for NPR comes from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock when it's on the move and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. After the fatal Bering airplane crash earlier this month, residents in nearly 20 villages came out to their local airstrips to greet planes, hug the pilots, and pray together. Officials are starting to look into the crash and examine the state's long-standing aviation safety challenges. But as Alona Nyden with the Alaska Desk reports, people in the region are standing by each other in the meantime.
Gullivan was one of at least 19 villages where residents honored the victims and expressed their support for the pilots and staff of the regional airline. In Shennock, people held hands and circled the plane after it landed. In Brevik Mission, people made signs and posters. In many places, people prayed, and in others, they sang in Alaska Native languages. Shennock resident Leona Komak was among those singing.
That's what our people do. You know, we're there for one another.
The idea came from a health aide in Sawunga who wanted to uplift residents after the heartbreak. People in Sawunga greeted the plane with a song that a late local elder translated into St. Lawrence Island Yupik in the early 70s after his son died. Since then, the community has been singing it during funerals. This time, they sang it to wish the victims of the crash an everlasting life. Four people on board the flight lived in Northwest Alaska. Others had close local ties, says Velma Jones from Noatak, a community of about 500 where 50 people showed up to the airstrip.
We feel it, and we feel for their families.
Investigators have emphasized that the cause of the Bering Air crash, which killed all 10 on board, is still unclear. But documented gaps in the state's weather reporting system have already been drawing attention, including by national transportation officials and Alaska's congressional delegation. The group held a press conference earlier this week where they brought up infrastructure issues in the state, which also has the highest rate of crashes in the nation. Specifically, Senators Murkowski and Sullivan pointed to known issues with Alaska's automated weather observing system, which helps pilots decide if it's safe to fly. University of Alaska Fairbanks climate specialist Rick Toman says that on any given day, 10 to 20% of the stations are down, and repairs are hard. Toman adds that efforts and funding for weather stations improvements have been limited.
From my perspective, okay, that's a start, but the amount of money that's been allocated is nowhere near sufficient to systematically address the problem.
Bering Air is the predominant air carrier in Northwest Alaska and is often the only way for residents to get to medical appointments, basketball games, and other communities, as well as to receive mail, groceries, and medical supplies. More than 80% of Alaskan communities are off the road system, making similar small regional air carriers an important lifeline. Velma Jones of Noatak says that pilots who commute people back and forth become a big part of their community.
You get to know them, like personally, like you would know your neighbor.
Kaylee Fagerstrom was one of dozens Gullivan residents who welcomed the Bering Air plane after they resumed operations. She says she wanted to express her support to victims' families and pilots after the crash.
So we're just showing our love to Bering Air so they don't give up on us and don't lose hope for anything.
The National Transportation Safety Board has been investigating the cause of Flight 445 crash. The preliminary report can take up to 30 days after the incident, and the final report can take up to several years. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
This is Alaska Public Media.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morn, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And its mama cries, 'cause if there's one thing that she don't need, it's another little hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. People, can't you understand? A child needs a helping hand, or he'll grow to be an angry young man someday. Take a look at you. Too blind to see, or do we simply turn our heads?
while the world turns. And a hungry little boy with a runny nose plays in the street as a cold wind blows in the ghetto. And his hunger burns. So he starts to roam the streets at night. He learns how to steal and he learns how to fight in the ghetto. And then one night, in desperation, the young man breaks away. He buys him a gun and he steals a car and he tries to run, but he don't get far. And his mama cries. As the crowd gathers round, an angry young man face down in the street with a gun in his hand in the ghetto. And a young man dies. On a cold and gray Chicago morn, another little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries.
Lights go out each evening at 11, and up and down our block there's not a sound. I close my eyes and search for peaceful slumber, and just then the local memory comes around. Piles up blues against the door, makes sure sleep will come no more. She's the hardest working memory in this town. Turns out happiness again, then lets loneliness back in. And each night the local memory comes around. Each day I say tonight I may escape her. I pretend I'm happy and never even frown. But at night I close my eyes and pray sleep finds me. But again, the local memory comes around. Rids the house of all good news, then sets out my crying shoes. What a faithful memory never lets me down. We're both up till light of day, chasing happiness away. And each night the local memory comes around. Your sleep will come no more. It's the hardest working memory in this town. Turns out happiness again, then lets loneliness back in. And each night the local memory comes around. And each night the local memory comes around.
Early one morning, with time to kill, I borrowed Jeb's rifle and sat on the hill. I saw a lone rider crossing the plain. I drew a bead on him to practice my aim. My brother's rifle went off in my hand. A shot rang out across the land. The horse he kept running, the rider was dead. I hung my head, I hung my head. I set off running to to wake from the dream. My brother's rifle went into the sheen. I kept on running into the Southlands. That's where they found me, my head in my hands. The sheriff, he asked me, why had I run? And then it came to me, just what I had done. And all for no reason, just one piece of lead. I hung my head, I hung my head. Here in the courthouse, the whole town was there. I see the judge high up in his chair. Explain to the courtroom what went through your mind. And we'll ask the jury what verdict they find. I felt the power of death over life. I orphaned his children, I widowed his wife. I beg their forgiveness, I wish I was dead. I hung my head, I hung my head, I hung my head, I hung my head. Early one morning, with time to kill, I see the gallows up on the hill. And out in the distance, a trick of the brain, I see a lone rider crossing the plain. And he come to fetch me to see what they done. And we'll ride together till kingdom come. I pray for God's mercy, cause soon I'll be dead. I hung my head, I hung my head, I hung my head, I hung my head.
Ride me on down. moonlight and you. The wallflower.